for the arts. Art works.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lurie. Well, coming up, we're going to speak with investigative journalist Chip Raleigh, who for decades has been tracking the far right in the U.S. With the rise of Donald Trump, far right groups are becoming more active, and we'll dive into their history, their motives, and their aims, what they're up to now. Later, we'll speak with MSNBC host Lawrence O'Donnell about his new book on 1968, one of the most pivotal years in recent American history. But first, our first guest is Chip Raleigh. For more than 30 years, he's covered far-right movements in the U.S. and in Europe. He'll be speaking this Friday in St. Petersburg. He's authored several articles and book chapters on white nationalism and neo-fascism and co-authored the entry on neo-Nazism in the current Encyclopedia Judaica. He's written about conspiracy theories, far-right religious groups, and political cults. For longtime listeners to WMNF, you may remember that Raleigh has given a number of talks on alternative radio about right-wing populism. He'll be speaking in St. Petersburg this Friday at 7 p.m. The talk is free and open to the public. It's part of the Leif Nissen Social Justice Lecture Series of Temple Beth El, and it's being held at the Allendale Methodist United Church in St. Petersburg. And Chip Raleigh, welcome to WMNF. Nice to have you here.
Well, thank you for having me.
So, Chip, I want to ask you about Charlottesville and what happened there a few months ago. This rally that ended up in violence and ended up with a young woman being killed, one of the people that was anti-racist, peacefully protesting, she was run over. What's the significance of what was then called a Unite the Right rally? What's the significance of the right doing that?
Well, the united part of the right is the goal of the people who want to replace democracy in the United States with a form of fascism. That's the title of the talk is White Nationalism, Anti-Semitism, and Neo-Fascism as Threats to U.S. Democracy, which, and these are all connected. In Charlottesville, you had the most overt, primarily male, angry, torch-bearing, although they were tiki torches, but still, a group of people who see themselves as neo-fascists. And, of course, neo-fascism can bleed over into neo-Nazism. But it also is part of a white nationalist campaign on the part of sectors of the U.S. right, which even many Republicans abhor, to basically reclaim, quote-unquote, America for white people.
So is the movement growing, would you say?
Definitely growing. It's measurably growing, according to social scientists. And it's been growing for a number of years, although slowly. But with the campaign of Donald Trump, which I began covering in late 2015, you could hear this kind of right-wing populist demagoguery, which basically tells people that they're under threat, that their way of life is under threat, and they need to fight back. And so this is the most overt, most militant, and most far-right of the movements that came out of that. The alt-right, anti-black, anti-Muslim, anti-gay, usually, although not always, but definitely anti-democracy.
I want to go back to the Unite the Right concept.
Mm-hmm.
Was the right, I mean, we're talking about the really, we're not talking about somebody that's just, you know, in favor of tax cuts. We're talking about people that really want to change the country and maybe take away rights for people of color that you maybe want to deport them, create an ethno state. Was the right really divided? And if so, what were the major streams of the right before this attempt to unite them in Charlottesville?
Well, if you look at the U.S. political right, just like on the political left, there's sort of shades of difference heading out to the more militant and more violent groups. So that what you had on the right were the mainstream Republicans. You had then the kind of right-wing movement groups built around theories of economy, libertarian economy versus a managed capitalist economy. You had people who disagreed over the role of race. You had people who disagreed over the role of gender. And you had people who disagreed about authoritarianism. And so that many Republicans were welcoming, certainly not all, but many Republicans were welcoming to people of color, to gay people, to people from different ethnicities and religions. But there began to be a widening split in the Republican Party, which moved it over to where they began to associate and interact with some of the milder organized white nationalist groups out on what I call the ultra-right. And that synthesis created what's called alt-right, and that began to shatter the core of the old Republican Party.
Mm. When you say the old Republican Party, I'm thinking of guys like Jack Kemp, the former football player from Buffalo who was a congressman. And really, in 10 or 15 years ago, when he was still alive, he died as a young man, but 10 or 15 years ago, he was really advocating expanding the Republican Party to include people of color and some of the other groups that the Democratic Party had really made inroads with.
That's correct, and then this was a major movement, and still is within the Republican Party. But what got in the way was the changing demographics of the United States, the collapse of the future of the middle class economy, and essentially the idea of austerity as the solution, which is going on around the world and is creating similar movements in Europe, but also the rearrangement of the tax structure in which billionaires pick our pockets and pull money out of the economy. So it's basically there was changing demographics and changing economic situation that was built essentially to reward certain people and punish the rest of us.
Do you think that brand of Republicanism is dead?
No, I don't think it's dead. I just like I don't think McGovern Democratic Party people all committed suicide in 1972.
Okay. We're talking with Chip Raley, who's going to be speaking this Friday night at 7 o'clock at the Allendale United Methodist Church in St. Petersburg, and we'll tell you more about that in just a moment. So, Chip, I remember when I first heard you talk, you were talking about groups like Christian Identity, and
right.
You were talking about the kind of movement that generated a Timothy McVeigh, who was responsible for the Oklahoma City bombing. Have those what is Christian Identity?
Well, Christian Identity is an extremely tiny but vicious form of Christianity. I'm a practicing Christianity. I don't recognize it as a form of Christianity at all. But it basically says that Jews are essentially the spawn of Satan and need to be exterminated, and that if you people who call themselves Jews, because Christian Identity argues that the real Jews wandered around, ended up in England, and came over and were the founders of the United States. So if you know your real Christian identity, you're one of the chosen people of God as a Jew. The real Jews, thus, are Christian Identity white Christians, whereas the fake Jews are these, you know, folks who claim to be Jews but really are different races and different religious backgrounds who really are working on behalf of Satan. Now, when I say that, people go, oh, you can't be serious. People don't really believe that. But I've been to Christian Identity meetings, and trust me, they really do believe that, and they've written extensively on it.
Yeah.
So that's part of the problem, is the fact that when you talk about really out there religious ideas, very many journalists just say that, you know, that's not true. But I'll point out that in New Jersey, during the Obama administration, a very reputable polling company asked New Jersey Republicans if they thought that Obama, the president, might be an agent of Satan and maybe even the chief agent of Satan in the end times, Armageddon. And something like 14% of Republican voters said it might be possible, and another 14% said it was probably true.
I can say that I've been to a Christian Identity event that took place in St. Petersburg about 20 or 25 years ago. They do preach exactly what you just said.
Creepy.
Yeah, it's very strange. So are they a player today in the far right?
I would say no. I mean, they're in the stands, as it were, but it's such an obscure movement that it blossomed in the 80s and 90s, but pretty much after the Oklahoma City bombing, it retreated back into a much more obscure locales, although they're still out there. But it turns out that McVeigh and the other participants in the bombing were more influenced by the most militant wing of the militia movement, and McVeigh himself had gotten intersected with a kind of neo-Nazi cell in Arizona, so that you know, the idea of the propaganda of the deed, the bombing of a building full of people was carried out really by a neo-Nazi kind of movement.
McVeigh, I think it's fair to say, envisioned himself as at war with the federal government. Is that a popular part of the far-right stream today in America?
Well, within what I would call the ultra-right, because it's, you know, these shades get so difficult to explain. Yes, in the ultra-right, the idea is that the federal government has this, been seized by a parasitic elites run by the labor unions, by people of color organizations, by basically Jewish bankers, a whole laundry list of these parasitic elites, and that the federal government is controlled by these parasitic elites and has to be overthrown and restored to the real people who turn out, not surprisingly, to be white Christians.
Is that group on the upswing? Is that that kind of general philosophy on the upswing in the
country? Clearly, yeah, immeasurably, yes, it is.
Yeah, we're talking with Chip Raleigh, who's covered the far right here in the U.S. for more than 30 years. He was a student activist in the 1960s, I read, and I read one of your first jobs was working for High Times magazine. Is that right?
It's so true, yes. I was. We were the radical splinter group from the Yippies. We called ourselves the Zippies and came down to Miami Beach in 1972.
And you were an anti-war activist back then?
Yes. Before that phase, I was an anti-war activist and also a racial justice activist. Read Martin Luther King's letter from Birmingham jail, and it changed my life.
As it did many people.
Yeah.
So, so is there much to be worried about? You know, when Richard Spencer came to Gainesville a few weeks ago, almost everybody on campus in Gainesville at the University of Florida was there to protest him. And there were a few supporters that came from across Florida. A couple dozen supporters came. I think some people may have been afraid to show their support for Spencer. But it looks like folks are pushing back as these far right-wing people try to establish a base or try to, you know, gain support. What's your take on whether or not they're successfully growing their movement?
They're successfully growing their movement in a very small measure. Meanwhile, we're not paying attention to the drift and crisis of American democracy with the administration of Donald Trump and the people he has appointed to gut all the federal agencies that protect our environment, our health, and our labor unions, and just about anything else most of us depend on. So I guess my argument is that, yes, the ultra-right is growing, but in the meantime, America's facing a crisis of democracy, which all of us who have good hearts and good minds should join together to try and fix.
When I've heard you speak in the past, especially during tough economic times in the 80s and 90s, I think you pointed out pretty often that as people felt economic pain, they were looking for scapegoats, so they would look at non-Christians or they would look at people of color and try to scapegoat them, blame them for their problems. When, you know, it was the factory that laid him off, or it was the, you know, the corporation that paid him minimum wage or a little bit, or was cutting their health care benefits or cutting their pension. But they got angry at, you know, folks like, you know, people of color, Jews, other folks. Is that still a dynamic today in the growth of the right in the U.S.?
Well, you just explained it as well as I can. Yes, that's exactly the dynamic. And we tend to not want to report as journalists, which is my background originally, is as journalists, that this dynamic has terrible repercussions in a democracy when it's much easier to write about Spencer and the torch-bearing alt-right crowd.
Mm-hmm. So what you talked about President Trump, I think there's, you know, a lot of people who are going to be listening who are President Trump supporters who might say to you, you know, I voted for him because he's a Republican. He was the standard bearer of my party. I'm not a fascist. I don't support, you know, the Hitler-style things. So when you tie Trump to the rise of this movement, people say, wait a minute, Chip Raleigh, that's going too far. I'm just a garden variety Republican.
Right, and I'm not going to say just because you voted for Trump, you're a Nazi. That's ridiculous. And in fact, I speak to what I would call mixed groups, Trump voters and people who voted for Clinton and people who chose not to vote at all or voted for Bernie Sanders or wrote in somebody. I think we're talking about building a coalition that extends well into the Republican Party to restore democratic civil society and to hold Trump and his administration accountable, as so many Republicans are starting to say, including those in high office. So that I'm not trashing, you know, the idea that they're, I'm not saying the Republicans caused this. What I'm saying is that the Republicans have to be part of a solution.
Chip Riley is our guest. He'll be speaking this Friday night at 7 o'clock at the Leif Neeson Social Justice Lecture of Temple Beth El, and it's being held at the Allendale United Methodist Church in St. Pete. That's at 3803 Haynes Road North in St. Petersburg. And you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. This, the emergence of far-right groups is not just happening here. It's happening in Scandinavia. It's happening in Western Europe. Are the causes the same?
They're identical. I work with journalists and social scientists across Europe, and as well, I might point out, in India and other countries where this right-wing populist scapegoating mechanism is working to build constituencies that want to essentially ethnically cleanse their societies. So that it's part of idea of the World Bank and other groups that austerity was going to fix our economic problems. I understand the idea, but it failed. And now we're in a middle period where countries around the world are trying to figure out how to deal with their economic and political health and are struggling. And so you see the rise of these right-wing populist movements. And the current theory of Professor Griffin and others is that fascism is the most militant form of right-wing populism. And most right-wing populist movements never become fascist, but several times, especially in Germany, one did.
Well, a lot of people have written about the parallels between early 1930s Germany and the U.S. today. Do you subscribe to the parallel? And if so, explain why you do.
Well, there's a great set of essays called The Fragility of Democracy on the Facing History and Ourselves website, which talks about the fragility of what we call the Weimar moment, the period before Hitler took power, when people didn't unite across party lines to stop him, and that was their error. So that I think we're in a crisis. We call it the tipping point or the Weimar moment, but it really demands of all of us to step up and stop this.
Well, I think one of the things that happened in early 1930s Germany is that the far left really thought very little of Hitler and thought that they would take over once Hitler, you know, ran his course, that he would fail. And the Social Democrats, the folks who were in the middle, were fighting with the far left, and vice versa. The far left was fighting with the Social Democrats. Neither group on the liberal to the left side trusted each other.
Right, and that was one of the major errors, as well as understanding that there were many people who were not on the left who were willing, you know, if asked, to join a coalition to stop Hitler. And that, I think, is the lesson of Professor Bookbinder, is that we're in a moment now where a unified kind of response that crosses party lines, and we don't want to destroy the Democratic Party so that the country collapses into the hands of the left, because that's a fantasy, and we don't want to look at everyone who voted for Trump or everyone in the Republican Party as the enemy. There are more of us who want to defend democracy than there are those who want to destroy it.
I want to ask you about the proper response. So let's say that a far right group is planning to hold a speech in somebody's town or hold a rally nearby. What do you think the proper response for people who enjoy small d democracy, enjoy the multiracial society that we have, the diverse society that we have, want to preserve it, don't want to go backwards, want to preserve rights for LGBTQ people? What's the proper response if there is a Nazi coming to your town to speak?
When Nazis come to town, well, I think there's two responses. One, for people who don't want to confront them directly, there should be some sort of ceremony or rally or meeting to celebrate diversity. And then for those people who feel compelled to confront them, I don't approve of beating up people in the streets. That's not democracy. I think it's masculinist nonsense. It's macho boys, primarily, and some macho women. It basically, humor helps. If it's a march, there's a town in Germany that painted lines every couple hundred yards saying, you have now raised 10,000, equivalent in U.S. dollars. And every few hundred yards, they were raising hundreds of thousands of dollars, because the longer they marched, the more they had commitments to raise money against racism. And just humor. I mean, when there's a Nazi rally and they shout white power, there's a bunch of clowns that run around and throw white flowers in the air, and then they run around and throw white flour, like, from baking in the air. And, you know, Nazis don't have that kind of sense of humor about their ideology. So, you know, mocking them, making fun of them, I don't have a problem. Free speech includes, in a public place, trying to shout them down. That's tough. I believe in a college lecture, I don't believe in stopping the lecture by creating a division, because that is exactly what they want, to make themselves the heroes.
Mm. A few weeks ago, I got an email from a very conservative listener, and maybe you've seen this email too. It said on, I think it was November 3rd or 4th, it was the Saturday of that weekend, George Soros spending $18 billion to hold riots around the U.S. And you know, you look at these sort of things, these internet rumors that we all get, we all see. Did you hear about that one? And if you didn't, just back up and talk about the internet rumors that, you know, President Obama was born in Kenya and legally did not have the right to be the president of the U.S. When we get these internet rumors, what's your response?
Well, it obviously builds division and fractures democracy. This is more than fake news. These are lies. These are propaganda lies. I know that some people who start them believe them, but some people don't. I know that these things are then reported on. I know that folks that actually watch Fox News, apologies, know less about how the government is functioning than people who watch other forms of news. So I think the basis of a free society is the fourth estate of the journalism that has failed in the last 10 years in this country. And it's a problem, because right now the false propaganda scapegoating message is, you'll pardon the term, trumping the democratic civil society news.
Where do you think that fake news comes from? I mean, the George Soros $18 billion riot thing never happened.
No, but I wish I had money from George Soros. I don't. None of my friends who organize demonstrations are getting packets of money. You know, I can, you know, leave my address later if he wants to call. But
it
isn't happening. It's just not happening. I guess he's funding, you know, civil rights, human rights, pro-gay, pro-ethnicity acceptance stuff all over the world. So that's nothing new.
But this stuff comes over my transom, maybe comes over your transom, into my inbox, and none of it turns out to be true. And then when you try to back up the source or find out what the source of this is, you find out that they're not telling the truth. It reminds me of a lot of the information that comes over InfoWars. I mean, there are these websites that promulgate these. You don't want to call it fake news; you call it lies.
It's lies.
I mean, what do you think of InfoWars, for instance?
Well, it's despicable. You know, it's not journalism. It's, you know, sludge. The problem is, whether or not the folks at InfoWars believe what they're saying, there are people who believe these conspiracy theories. They're small in number, but they're very vociferous. So these people generate these conspiracy theories, and then they get, you know, replayed through Twitter accounts and Facebook accounts. And there are a lot of conspiracy theorists on the left and right who believe these things. And, of course, that makes it very difficult to have a sensible conversation about political life in America.
What's the real aim of conspiracy theories?
To make the person spreading the rumor a hero. Ultimately, the person is Paul Revere. They're offending the alarm. It doesn't matter whether it's true or not. Or I think many of them, and I've talked to many of them, they think it's true, and they want to save America, and they make themselves the heroes, and they get attention. These are attention-seeking people who have developed a way to make scapegoating a method of improving their status and their pocketbook.
And it seems like every one of those conspiracy theories is aimed to divide people, especially at the bottom level, at the middle class level, the working class level, divide, you know, poor whites from poor blacks.
Right, it's all about dividing the country into the people who know what's really going on and the people who don't, and it's like a giant vice squeezing the real people who know it all in the middle, and there are bad parasitic people up above and bad parasitic people down below, and us people with this conspiracy theory know who's really pulling the levers, and we in the middle have to revolt against the parasites above and below who are spreading this destruction.
Were conspiracy theories important to the rise of fascism in Germany?
Absolutely, especially ones about Jews, but also other conspiracy theories were widespread. That's where you get the motif, really on the political level, in modern society of the Jewish banker, a thing that you can track back all the way to Shakespeare. And so that the idea of powerful elites who control the money supply goes back easily to the 14th, 15th, 16th century, but was expanded by Hitler in the massive conspiracy theories about the Rothschild banking family and the Jewish bankers who controlled all of the money.
Well, Chip Raleigh, thank you so much for coming on WMNF. Chip Raleigh is a longtime investigative journalist, and he studied far-right movements in the U.S. and Europe. He'll be speaking this Friday at the Allendale United Methodist Church in St. Petersburg. That's at 3803 Haynes Road North. It's at 7 p.m. And Chip, thank you so much. If people want to find out more about the kinds of investigations that you've done and the kinds of things you've written, where can they find it?
Well, I blog at researchforprogress.org, and I want to plug the University of South Florida, Unitarian Universalist, League of Women Voters, and Fired Up for co-sponsoring the event.
Chip Raleigh, thanks a lot.
Thanks for coming on
WMNF. Great to have you here.
Oh, and it'll start with a Shabbat service at 7 p.m., and the lecture starts at 7:45.
Very good. All right, Chip, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
All right,
bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye. That's a longtime investigative journalist, Chip Raleigh, and Raleigh is spelled B-E-R-L-E-T. Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. Well, 1968 was a pivotal time in modern American history. It had several assassinations, the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. The Vietnam War was practically at its peak. There was a big presidential election happening that fall, and President Johnson at the beginning of the year thought that he would cruise to re-election, but he was challenged by Eugene McCarthy, a senator from Minnesota, a Democrat who long wanted to be president. And in his new book, Lawrence O'Donnell of MSNBC has written about that important year in our history. Playing with Fire is his book, The 1968 Election and the Transformation of American Politics. And I spoke with Lawrence O'Donnell, the host of The Last Word on MSNBC, earlier this week. And here's the interview that we did. Lawrence O'Donnell, welcome to WMNF. Great to have you here.
Great to be here.
Before we launch into your book about 1968, Playing with Fire, I want to ask you about the president's trip to the Far East. Could you give me your rating of how he did on that trip?
Well, you know, the collapse of the Trans-Pacific Partnership is an illusion. It did not collapse. In fact, it is going forward. It was agreed to while Donald Trump was on this trip. It was agreed to by all the countries participating except the United States, which unwisely dropped out. This is 40% of the world's economy, was 40% of the world's economy with the United States involved, agreeing to the rules of the road in trade that would include almost all of Asia except China. And so it was going to be a very serious force for China to reckon with the United States participating in it. And that's what a trade deal is. What the Trump administration will pretend is a trade deal is simply announcing business deals, many of which were going to happen anyway, no matter who the president was, for an individual company selling individual products and things to Asian countries and other way around, Asian countries selling things to us and so forth. And in the middle of this trip, the president said to the Japanese, would you please consider making your cars in the United States instead of just shipping them? So this is the most ignorant president who's ever been in a discussion about any of this, who does not know that three-fourths of the cars that we call Japanese cars are made in the United States and sold to customers in the United States. And so there's nothing of any importance that can be gained in at the governing level, when you're talking about individual companies making individual deals in foreign countries, deals that they've been making long before there was a Trump presidency and without the need for any governmental help in making those deals.
You know, I think a glaring omission, too, both on the president's part and on the part of the reporters covering the trip, are any questions about human rights in factories in China. That issue didn't come up, and we know that earlier this year, a couple of investigators from the U.S. were going to China to look at Ivanka Trump's factories, and they were arrested by the Chinese, apparently, you know, trying to point out poor working conditions. I mean, Trump never brings those up. He's not trying to increase the pay in China or increase the working conditions in China, and the press seems to have ignored that issue this trip, or am I wrong? What do you think?
Well, I share everyone's frustration with the White House press corps and the traveling press corps, but they are frustrated too. And our frustration as we sit on the sidelines is, why didn't they ask this? Why didn't they ask that? What their frustration is, why don't we get to ask anything? There are press conferences or press opportunities, things that are supposed to be press opportunities, where they're not allowed to ask any question at all. And so then when they are allowed to ask a question, it's most likely to be about the explosive controversy of the day, as opposed to some ongoing underlying condition like labor in China. The number thing, when you think of the number of questions the White House press corps would have today before they would get to that, just about the business at hand with the Republican tax bill and so forth, I can understand why they don't ask a lot of the questions I wish they asked, but almost all the time there are very direct questions about the news of the day that they don't ask the way I would want them to ask it anyway. And so that's just that frustration we all share, because there's this tiny little group of people who are allowed to ask a tiny number of questions to a president who doesn't answer them even when they're asked.
We're talking with Lawrence O'Donnell, the MSNBC host, and his new book is called Playing with Fire, the 1968 Election and the Transformation of American Politics. So, Lawrence, I was surprised in reading your book that in 1968, I guess I knew this because I was in eighth grade in 68, but, Vietnam was the centerpiece of all the discussion. Economic issues barely made an appearance. You know, the economy was central to Trump's win to, the 2008 presidential election, 1980, 1992, 1996, all those presidential elections. The economy was central. In 68, Vietnam was central. Why the difference? Why was Vietnam central in 68?
Because in 1968, 16,589 American families had a military funeral to bury an American soldier killed in Vietnam. My family had a funeral for my cousin Johnny in 1968. 90 days after he graduated from West Point, he was killed in Vietnam. He was one of the more than 16,000 that year. Just to give you a scale for this, and for people who weren't alive in 1968, in the 16 years that we have been fighting in Afghanistan and Iraq, the total combined dead from both Afghanistan and Iraq of U.S. Casualties is 6,883. That is less than half of the number killed in Vietnam in 1 year in 1968. And so that galvanized the country. You were for or against the war. And at the beginning of the year, it felt like it was a minority against the war, a small minority against the war, until Senator Eugene McCarthy, as a Democrat, went to New Hampshire, challenged the sitting Democratic president's war policy, and ran against his own Democratic president, something that was inconceivable. And in effect, Gene McCarthy put the war on the ballot, and we discovered it's not a small minority position, the anti-war movement. And Gene McCarthy finished a very, very strong second against Lyndon Johnson in New Hampshire, and people realized the anti-war movement is a large and important political force. And if Gene McCarthy hadn't made that decision, we would never have known that.
You mentioned Iraq and Afghanistan. I mean, those wars have been dragging on, and now we find out that American soldiers are being shot at in other countries, Niger and other places. U.S. is backing militaries in Yemen and Syria and all around the world. There's, I think there's 8 or 9 countries in which the U.S. is engaged militarily. Is the difference the draft? That is, that everybody had a stake in Vietnam, whereas today we've got this volunteer military.
Yeah, the difference is the draft, and our politics would change dramatically if there was a draft. If Donald Trump Jr. had even the same exposure to the draft that his father had, and he had to go to the trouble of finding a doctor who would write a note about bone spurs, he would be much more connected to our war policy and have a much stronger view of our war policy than he currently does. I mean, I know people who were in SDS, which was the kind of one of the more extreme student protest organizations, extreme left protest organizations. They were in SDS in 1968, and they are Republican voters today. And the difference is the draft card, that when that person's own life was threatened by our war policy, that guy was an anti-war liberal. And as soon as you removed the threat of war from his own life, of having to, you know, participate in the Vietnam War, you released the possibility that he could focus on other issues. And so the people I know who went from SDS to being Republicans went from focusing on saving their own lives in this war by ending it and staying out of it to worrying about how much taxes they pay. And they could focus on, they had the luxury to focus on taxes because the government was no longer threatening their lives. And to understand what it feels like to have the government threatening your life every day, you have to have lived in 1968 with the draft at a point where the war had clearly become unwinnable, which it proved to be, and was dragging on relentlessly because we had a president who did not want to be the first president to lose a war. And the fact is, we did lose the war in the end, and we gained absolutely nothing by fighting it. North Vietnam won completely, totally victorious. We were utterly defeated, and that's the president of the United States should have gotten us out of that in 1965, but it dragged on because of this presidential fear of being the first president to lose a war. And then Nixon behaved exactly the same way when he got elected, didn't want to be the first president to lose a war, so he dragged it on for years.
I got to say that I know some members of who were in the SDS and opposed to the war, and today they're still committed to those old values, though, anti-war.
That's true too. Yeah. I wouldn't want to say, you know, that example I was giving was the norm. I would say most people did not move that way in that direction or from that extreme to, you know, this other position. But it did happen because of that release of pressure that the government put on everyone in the 1960s.
Johnson continued to defend the war publicly, even though privately he had doubts. To what extent was there an unreasonable or unrational fear of communism? Because I'm thinking of the President Trump's visit, he was just in Vietnam. There are American factories in Vietnam. We buy cheap goods from Vietnam. Vietnam turned out not to be hostile to us. It turned out to be one of our foreign labor camps or foreign factory sites.
Well, it certainly became a, when the North Vietnamese won the war, it became a communist country. And like all communist countries that wanted to modernize, it realized that communism, to put it mildly, has its limits and there's things that aren't going to work in communism, as China found out. And so they softened. They softened their communism to allow in an amount of capitalism, and basically they do what every country in the world tries to do, which is mix We call them, in economics, we call them mixed economies. Every country in the world is a mixed economy, and it mixes socialism with capitalism. In Vietnam now, they use much more socialism than we do, but they also use capitalism. We use capitalism and we use socialism. You know, Sweden uses more socialism than we do. But we're all playing with the mix. We're all turning the dial. You know, and you know, in the 60s, we add Medicare and Medicaid to our socialist mix. And in the 30s, we had added Social Security to our socialist mix. And at the same time, capitalism continues to rage on, not inhibited by these socialist mixes that are brought into the economy to soften the harshness of capitalism. And so the Vietnamese had to soften the harshness of communism. And so Donald Trump visited a communist country that has evolved into a mixed economy with communist roots. And he, like all American presidents now, has absolutely no problem with Vietnam and the way it conducts itself in the world.
Our guest is Lawrence O'Donnell. The book is Playing with Fire, the 1968 Election and the Transformation of American Politics. Lawrence, there's so much I want to ask you. I want to ask you about Bobby Kennedy, but we're down to the last 5 minutes. In your book, you talk extensively about how Richard Nixon essentially committed treason. How so?
Yeah, that's what LBJ called it when he discovered it. The CIA brought to President Johnson's attention their discovery that Richard Nixon was colluding with a foreign power during the presidential campaign. He was colluding with South Vietnam. Nixon was telling the South Vietnamese government through emissaries and through their embassy in Washington to hang on, don't take any steps toward peace, because hang on and I will get you a better deal. Meanwhile, Lyndon Johnson, having dropped out of the campaign, is desperately trying to bring peace to Vietnam, and he's trying to bring the parties to a peace table in Paris. And a week before the election, he gets the South Vietnamese to agree to go to Paris to sit at the table and to begin negotiating peace. And Richard Nixon intervenes, and 2 days after the South Vietnamese tell the president that they will come to Paris, they tell the president that they will not come to Paris. And at that point, LBJ starts studying everything the CIA has on Nixon's collusion and realizes what's going on, and he calls it treason when he sees it, and he says that to a Republican senator who he trusted, Senator Dirksen, hoping that Dirksen would tell Nixon that Johnson knew what he was up to, and Nixon has to stop that immediately. And it didn't work. And so Lyndon Johnson was thinking about going public and telling the New York Times and telling the Washington Post what Nixon was up to a couple of days before the election. And his senior advisors, Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State, said, don't do it. You will expose our intelligence gathering methods. We cannot do that. And also, people might not believe you because it will look political if 2 days before the election you tell people that Richard Nixon is violating the law and he's colluding with the South Vietnamese government. And Johnson was agonized, and he decided to go along with his advisors and not make it public. And Nixon won by less than 1% of the vote, and he would not have won without every little thing that he did, including his collusion with a foreign power.
Johnson used the word treason in that private conversation on the phone with Everett Dirksen that people can hear online. Those audio recordings are out. But did LBJ wimp out?
No, I don't think he did. I think if you read the book and you go through this passage, you will see the agony that he was facing. To me, it's what I call a presidential decision, meaning there's no good decision. The decisions that come to the president are never the easy ones. And so I think he had a very serious issue there on compromising their intelligence gathering techniques in Washington. They were wiretapping a lot of embassies at the time, including the Soviet embassy, and they didn't want people to know exactly how they were gathering this information. And Nixon would have had to present it all. I mean, LBJ would have had to reveal it all, how they were doing it. And also, there was another part of it that I have less sympathy with, is that they were worried about what they called the good of the country. It's not good for the country to think that one of their presidential candidates would actually do something like this. And that's back in a day when impeachment was inconceivable to these people. Nothing like it had ever happened. You know, something that had happened 100 years before and was never taken seriously. And so they thought, you know, Nixon might actually win. This was another part of LBJ's advisors. What they had to say was Nixon might actually win, and it would be very bad for the country to know that he won through this kind of crime. And so that's how much these wise men believed in the protection of the imagery of government back then. I can understand how they got into that mindset. I've never shared it, but I do understand how they could see it that way. The thing I do recognize as a very difficult presidential decision there is the revealing of all the techniques they used to discover this information. And that would be that would have been a difficult thing for them to do. So I think I would have been one of those advisors saying, make it public, but I wouldn't have thought that the advisors saying, don't make it public, were crazy.
Well, Lawrence O'Donnell, thanks a lot. That's all the time we have. I wish we had more time. But Lawrence, thank you so much for coming on WMNF.
Thank you very much.
Great to talk to you. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Rob.
That was Lawrence O'Donnell, the host of The Last Word on MSNBC, formerly an Emmy Award-winning executive producer and writer for the TV show The West Wing. O'Donnell was a senior advisor to Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan from New York and chief of staff to the Senate Committee on the Environment and Public Works and the Senate Finance Committee. He's out with a new book called Playing with Fire, the 1968 Election and the Transformation of American Politics. And whether or not you live through 1968 or whether or not you look back on it as purely history, it's a fascinating book at a look at a pivotal year, perhaps the most pivotal year in recent American history. Well, let's open up the phone lines and take your phone calls. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. You can send your email into the studio here at dj@wmnf.org. So if you want to talk about any of the things that were brought up in these two interviews, the interview with Chip Relay and now the interview with Lawrence O'Donnell, we can talk about it. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Email address, dj@wmnf.org. Well, conservatives seem to have really gotten themselves lathered up about Hillary Clinton, and there are calls for an investigation into the sale of a uranium company to a group that includes Russian interests. That sale happened during the Obama presidency. So that may happen. There may be yet another investigation into Hillary Clinton. And we're going to listen to something that Jimmy Kimmel did the other night on his TV show. Of course, Hillary Clinton is no longer in office. She has no political authority at all. Well, this is what Jimmy Kimmel found out when he went on the streets of Los Angeles and asked people whether or not Hillary Clinton should be impeached. Let's listen in.
The news lately is encouraging for the future of the Trump administration. So they're adding a new twist, something to maybe distract us. After public encouragement from the president, the Department of Justice is reportedly deciding whether or not to appoint a special counsel to investigate Hillary Clinton. But you have to be very careful investigating Hillary Clinton. If you say her name three times, she runs for president automatically. But at this point, Donald Trump would lock Hillary Clinton up for the murder on the Orient Express right now. And his supporters are so very passionate about hating Hillary Clinton, it seems sometimes like maybe they forgot she lost, that she's not the president. He's the president. But we went out on the street this afternoon. We asked people, should Hillary Clinton be impeached? Now, Hillary Clinton doesn't have a job to get impeached from, but did that stop people from demanding she be removed from office? Let's find out.
Do you think Hillary Clinton should be impeached?
Yes, definitely. For what she's done, the way that she's kind of more or less with the Russian deal and all that stuff going on, she definitely should be out.
Do you think Hillary Clinton should be impeached?
Yes.
For what crimes?
Really, I'm not a political person at all, so I really have no clue. Well, so, I mean,
would you support Congress in impeaching Hillary Clinton?
Yes. Yes, I would.
What are Hillary Clinton's impeachable offenses?
just besides for numerous lies to the public, probably all the emails that, you know, mysteriously just disappeared.
What kinds of crimes would you include in the articles of impeachment?
Extortion, treason. If there was a Benedict Arnold law, it'd be her. So, yeah, basically.
What kinds of crimes would you include in Hillary's articles of impeachment?
That's like a wide range of crimes, political crimes, I think human crimes. I mean, the list could go on.
What would it take for Congress to act now and remove Hillary from office?
Well, they really haven't done anything yet, so I think they should get together, definitely, and say, hey, this, you know, we the people should take care of the people of the United States, and what she has done is wrong. We should impeach her.
You tell me what is a bigger threat to America.
Okay.
Climate change or Hillary Clinton?
Hillary Clinton.
Guns or Hillary Clinton?
Hillary Clinton.
ISIS or Hillary Clinton?
They're about even.
Would you like to look into the camera and call on Congress to impeach Hillary Clinton?
She needs to be impeached. Hillary needs to be impeached.
Kevin, do you think Hillary Clinton should be impeached?
I don't know. If she broke the law and they found out that she... Oh, impeached? Yeah. No, Hillary ain't even in office. Never mind. You try to get me.
Well, finally, one person knew that Hillary Clinton wasn't in office. That was from the Jimmy Kimmel Show. You can see that on the Jimmy Kimmel website where he's got it posted. Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. Some of the big news this hour is that several media outlets, including the New York Times and... BuzzFeed News and The Washington Post are all reporting that Senator Al Franken kissed and groped a woman without her consent at a 2006 USO event. That's according to a broadcaster, a woman. The senator has apologized. The story is coming out in The Washington Post, BuzzFeed News, The New York Times, and CNN right now. Also, the Associated Press has a major new investigation that it's found that blobs of algae are fouling waterways across the U.S. An AP investigation finds little to show for efforts to reduce fertilizer runoff, a leading cause of the problem. And I think we're going to hear more about these kind of problems as more of those fertilizers create problems for, you know, in areas near farm areas. There's certainly a runoff problem here in the central part of Florida. Let's take some phone calls. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. And MRG writes, the folks that we just heard must be the folks who also voted for Donald Trump. I don't know who they voted for. These are folks that they found near the Hollywood Walk of Fame in downtown Los Angeles. Don't know if they all voted for Trump or whether they voted for somebody else or didn't vote at all. 813-239-9663 is our phone number, email address, dj@wmnf.org. Let's go to Mike in Tampa, who's been holding for a long time. Hi, Mike, you're on. What would you like to say?
Yeah, I just want to correct the record on what Skip Foy said, that the far left are not uniting with the social Democrats somehow. Hitler on the power, that's not true. It was actually the Social Democrats who handed Hitler the power.
Mike, what book are you citing? Because I've read pretty much what Chip has said. What book would you refer us to for your version of history?
Well, Wise and Fall of the Third Reich is one. Von Hindenburg was the one who made Hitler the chancellor of Germany.
But if you go deep into the history, I think you're going to find that the far left and the social democrats, the moderate liberals, were at war, not trusting each other at the time. You're going to find too that the communists thought that Hitler would be a failure once he came to power, and they wanted him to come to power, and thought that after a few years, the German people would just be so tired of Hitler that power would fall into the communist hands. That did not happen, because what Hitler did was he turned on the Social Democrats and on the communists alike and arrested many of their members. So I'm not sure I trust your version of history.
Vices and Big Business, which so clearly at the far left wanted to go all the way and have a revolution, and the Social Democrats didn't want that.
Again, I don't think that's true. I think, again, the communists, we'll have to get a historian on, because, Mike, neither you or I are historians, but I think Berlay has written a lot about this, and he's done a lot of investigation, and I'm sure he's read a lot of books on the topic. But we can't solve it here. I'm so sorry, Mike. I wish we could solve it. This is one of those things where we need an historian to come in. Chip has written a lot about history, so you know I do tend to think that he's got something to say. Mike, thanks a lot for your call. Great to hear from you. If you want to comment about today's show, please call us up at 813-238-8001 and record your comment on extension 115. And we'll play those comments back tomorrow at 11 o'clock. Mitch Perry is coming up next on the Midpoint program. You're listening to 88.5 FM. This is WMNF in Tampa. And all this afternoon, we'll be broadcasting live from the Et Cultura Festival, which is taking place right now in St. Petersburg. Lots of events, films and lectures and concerts. It's a great event that's happening in St. Pete this week. This is 88.5 FM, WMNF, Tampa, St. Petersburg.